This morning, the stage is set in Texas for some all-out political warfare following the overnight results of key primary races, races that are being looked at by both parties for clues to what we might see in the fall.
Here they are. You can see them. Greg Kassar with 61% right now. Eddie Rodriguez, 16%.
I'm going to tell y'all the truth. These people never celebrate nothing, okay?
It's just such a lazy view.
Y'all still mad about Joe Crowley. That's what it is.
Hello, I'm Guido Gergenti, and today we're doing something new. The first big Democratic primaries of the 2022 cycle have happened. Our team sifted through the results, read the post-election hot takes, and now we're bringing back group chat to make sense of it all. Do these Texas primaries tell us anything important about the left in American elections this year? What works, what doesn't? Where did we do well? Where do we disappoint ourselves? But first, before group chat, before we really get into the takes, we gotta review the basics. Top line results in Texas 35 and Texas 28. Big picture, what happened in these races? So before group chat, I sat down with Justice Democrat's new campaign director, Jeff Simpson, to break down the numbers and look back on the strategies that really mattered. Jeff did a great job laying out what happened. Before electoral politics, Jeff was a professional basketball player and coach in Europe, and I think you'll see his knack for clear, insightful post-game analysis. So, before group chat returns, we're rolling out a new segment. Campaign Breakdown with Coach Jeff.
Coach, is that adjustment want to go with in the second game?
Well, this game just ended, so give me a little time.
Folks, he played college ball at Oberlin before going pro in England. He went on to coach youth teams across the continent.
We've had a hell of a year, and
now he's back in the States.
We have an opportunity to win a championship tomorrow night.
Coach Jeff Simpson, the incoming Justice Democrats campaign director, breaks down the big primaries of the 2022 season. Hey, Jeff. How you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks, Guido. Happy to be here.
Jeff, you were actually a coach, right? Before you were a campaign director. This is a real thing.
I was.
You really did play professional ball in Europe.
I did, yeah. Right out of college, got to play in London for a year, got to coach while I was there. Saw myself playing for many years and really saw myself as a coach. That's what I wanted to do. And then, of course, life happens and my dad got sick, had to come home from the second team I signed for in Germany to take care of him. And that's what really, really radicalized me and got me into left politics and kind of put basketball to the side and started this campaign work in 2016. And here we are in 2022.
We're glad to have you. Glad that your dad's doing all right now.
Yeah, thank you.
So, intern on a campaign in 2016. 6 years later, you're the incoming campaign director for Justice Democrats. First two games of the season, Texas 35 and Texas 28.
To continue the sports metaphor, we're 1-0 with Greg's race, and Jessica's race is going to overtime. But we can talk about Greg's race first. And we saw Greg win resoundingly, a really big win for the left. He took 61% of the vote in the March 1st primary. That was key because we needed over 50% to avoid a runoff. And, obviously 61 was a big number for Greg. His next two closest opponents were around 15% of the vote each. Big win for Greg. And we can talk a little bit about why that was.
What I'm hearing from you is that you had expectations and Greg exceeded those expectations.
Yeah, it's not that I was underestimating him in any way. I was familiar with Greg from my past work in Texas. I knew he'd been doing the work on the left in Austin for a long, long time. But, seeing how the field broke out, it was a crowded field. You had a state rep in the field. You had a former San Antonio City councilor in the field. Some folks who I thought would be more well-known and would be able to build strong political coalitions, but I think overall, Greg's success is a testament to the campaign they ran. They ran a really strong campaign, but also the work he did before the campaign, the work he did organizing on the city council.
Yes, Greg was just 25 when he won his seat on Austin City Council. He's now 32, and 7 years into his time as an elected official at the municipal level, this is how his local Fox station covered his launch.
Probably the most progressive person on the Austin City Council. He hasn't just sat back and been an insider politician, but he's always been out there. So he's got a lot of name recognition, especially here within the city of Austin.
You know, he was a big part of Bernie Sanders' campaign in Texas. And so Greg, compared to a lot of our candidates, really started with an advantage in terms of name ID. A lot of people knew who Greg was right off the bat. And I know in like the initial polling, the campaign released publicly had Greg with a pretty sizable lead right from the start. And it was because of that work he did leading up to the election and, you know, his run for Congress. And I think part of the lesson we can learn on the left is that we need to build that bench from city council, school board, mayor's races, and that's going to help feed and give us an advantage in these congressional races if we do that early work, that organizing early on, even before the race for Congress opens up or starts.
You're saying Greg's advantage is that he's well known, and he earned that. At the same time, his closest rival, Eddie Rodriguez, is also a 9-term state representative in the Texas House. Why does Greg so outperform Eddie when Eddie's also an incumbent, has been around longer than Greg?
Yeah, it was interesting to me because Eddie's a state rep in the area, did not have as high of name ID. You know, I don't know Eddie well. What I knew from my previous Texas days is that Eddie was considered a progressive state rep. He was a progressive in the state house, one of the more progressive electeds there. It was really interesting to me. You could tell early on in the race, you know, he was endorsed by the New Democrat Coalition, who we know is a very moderate group. And then when he started some of his advertising and mailers, really made some bad faith attacks from the right, stuff that you would typically see from Republicans around some of the work Greg did to help the homeless in the city of Austin.
Yes, in 2019, Greg, as well as other council members, were leading an effort both to expand shelters and resources for homeless people in the city of Austin, but also to simply decriminalize the act of being in Austin without having a place to stay for a night.
To change our ordinances so that if somebody is actually doing something that we could identify as wrong, that we could still intervene. But if somebody is just homeless, if somebody is just sleeping in their car, or if somebody is just sitting on a corner asking for money, that we couldn't call that a criminal violation any longer.
This ordinance that Greg just described did pass in 2019, but then it was repealed by voters in the city of Austin in 2021. Maybe Eddie thought, if I send out a really scary mailer tying Greg to this thing that voters disliked, that can tip the scales.
Eddie did his best to carve out that moderate center lane, but it didn't feel authentic compared to the previous work he had done. I think voters can feel that. And at the end of the day, you know, I'm sure there were a lot of people advising Eddie, saying, you need to run in the middle. Greg's the guy on the left. You're not going to win on the left. You need to run in the middle. I get the theory behind that, but he did all that just to get 15% of the vote and lose by 45 points. Yeah, it didn't work out.
That's Texas 35. Big win, as Coach Jeff said, 1-0. Going down further south in Texas to San Antonio, all the way to the border. Texas is 28th district. Jessica Cisneros and Henry Cuellar are separated by about 700 votes.
Mm-hmm.
The top line numbers for the March 1st primary, Cuellar with 48% of the vote, Cisneros with 47% of the vote. And there's the third candidate, Tania Benavides, who got about 2,200 votes, 5%.
The good news is we kicked Cuellar's ass in San Antonio and won it by a massive, massive margin. The bad news is that he kicked our ass in the Rio Grande Valley and to a lesser extent, but still significant extent in Laredo.
What do you think? What happened?
We knew going in to this race, this cycle, that it was going to be a tougher climb than it was last cycle. Last cycle, we had the benefit of a presidential primary. Last cycle, we kind of caught Cuellar by surprise. I don't think he ran a particularly strong campaign last time. And this time around, we knew we were going to see lower turnout. A more sort of moderate electorate, and Cuellar really professionalized his campaign. He really took fundraising more seriously, raised a lot of money, and, you know, hired some professional folks, some good folks to help him out. So we knew it was going to be tougher than it was last time around. And I think the team on the ground worked really hard. Us at JD, we made a really big contribution directly to the campaign and also with our independent expenditure. And so to virtually tie him and come as close as we did to crossing that 50% line. And I know a lot of the folks in the district and nationally feel like if Tanya wasn't in that race, then, you know, she's another progressive woman running in the race that we could have crossed that 50% line if she wasn't in. And so to come that close, those are all positives to take away and stuff to replicate in the runoff. I think our performance in San Antonio in particular, we beat them 70-25 in the San Antonio media market. And that's sort of the offsetting percentages. That's why it's so close. And that's why you're seeing a virtual tie heading into the runoff.
You know, Jeff, JD is known for running candidates and investing in heavily Democratic, mostly urban districts. And this district, Texas's 28th district, I think is quite different from most of the places we invest in. You just spent a week there. Before we give a brief breakdown of the results, help us understand what kind of place we're talking about here.
Yeah. So the district spans from the U.S.-Mexico border, the Rio Grande Valley, all the way up to San Antonio. There's very different communities in the district. I mean, San Antonio, as we saw in the election, acts very differently from Laredo and the Rio Grande Valley. But having spent some time there, you know, simple stuff that I think a lot of people take for granted, like clean drinking water, other basic infrastructure, it's a problem down there. I was in Laredo and have spent about a month there now. Flew into Laredo. Day one, I get there. And later that night, we go to hang with some of the campaign folks. First time I'm meeting a lot of people. And we're at a staffer's house. And I go to get a drink of water out of the faucet, as I commonly do. I drink tap water.
Got to stay hydrated. Game day. Playoffs are coming.
That's right. And was immediately told, don't drink the water. You can't drink that water. And so from that day on, being there, we had to run all the water through like a Brita water purifier situation for drinking water. And that was in a nicer part of Webb County, a nicer part of Laredo. In South Webb, I know there are boil water notices consistently. People can't drink the water. They can't shower. There's lead in the water. They just lack basic infrastructure. And it's very clear that government has failed that part of the country massively. And I don't think it's unrelated to sort of the shifts we're seeing down there. Because when JD got involved with Jessica last cycle, it did seem like a safe blue district. And this cycle, it's very much becoming a swing seat. A lot of publications have it ranked as a toss-up. And we're seeing a lot of those takes about...
For the general, you're saying?
For the general election, yeah. For the general election, sorry. We're seeing a lot of those takes where reporters are writing left versus right, progressive moderate, Republican shift. And I think there's some truth to that. It's a socially more conservative area of the country. But I think one of the bigger things when you see the lack of infrastructure, the lack of good jobs, people having to go from Laredo across the border to Mexico to get basic health care, people in communities like Laredo in Webb County, Texas, not having clean drinking water. And those people feel that, and they feel like there's a political class who have failed them. And that's been our basic argument against Henry Cuellar the whole time. And that will, you know, if Jessica's lucky enough to win the runoff, be our argument throughout, because it resonates down there in a major way.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us for the first campaign breakdown. And we're excited to have you back the next time there are a few games to break down.
Sounds good.
All right, after the break, group chat returns JD All-Stars Amira, Waleed, the big boss. See you there.
Picture in Texas to me was it's sort of the appetizer for what primary season is going to deliver both parties, which is we're going to have progressives versus the centrists or the establishment primaries like Cisneros, Cuellar, and then you're going to have MAGA versus establishment or MAGA versus light MAGA.
Yep, you got a couple of those setups. Here's the progressive versus Henry Cuellar. You could call him conservative Democrat, least liberal Democrat in the House, something like that. Moderate Democrat, pick your label. Cisneros backed by AOC, backed by NAFTA progressive.
All right, welcome back to Group Chat. In the DMs today, Justice Democrats, political director.
Hi.
Our co-host, a fan favorite. I think this is the season two premiere, Amir Hassan.
Hi, I'm back.
How are you doing, Amir?
She's back. I'm doing good. I'm all right. I'm sweating.
How's Washington, D.C.?
It's a cool 50, which is where I like it. This weekend, it had the audacity to be nice and sunny and 70 degrees, and I did not like it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's this is my hot take.
That's the first hot take of the season.
My hot take. Yeah.
Joining us again, Justice Democrats Communications Director and co-host, Waleed Shaheed. Waleed, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Texas.
And Justice Democrats Executive Director, Alexandra Rojas. Alex, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I'm on my third cup of coffee. Let's go.
Yes, let's go. How many cups of coffee do you need to go straight from a March 1st primary into a May runoff?
A lot.
A lot. A lot. Coach Jeff gave us the breakdown. You're already caffeinated, so let's dive into the takes. National political journalists have already been making meaning of what are these Texas Democratic primaries telling us about the Democratic Party. Everyone is searching for clues about where things are headed in the midterms. But I'm going to put national political journalists aside for a second and start with you all. If we are going to make meaning, draw conclusions about national politics from congressional primaries, what meaning would you make of Councilman Greg Kazar defeating his closest rival by 45 points?
Stick with me, okay? Let me take you back.
Uh-huh.
Let me take you all the way back. November. 2021, a politician with high name rec, okay, backing from the highest places of the party and the benefit of having had the job that they were running for already, loses his race. Who am I speaking of? Why am I speaking about Terry McAuliffe, Virginia? Because, here, stick with me, okay? This man loses his race. The party in shambles. Who do they say is at fault? Progressives. They say this man who had this job, who has high name recognition, loses because infrastructure package did not pass.
Yes, quick refresher on the Terry McAuliffe discourse for folks who weren't following that closely in October 2021. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe himself was on CNN a few weeks before the election, maybe preemptively passing the buck and saying, this is because we haven't passed the bipartisan infrastructure bill.
We've got frustration with Washington. You know, why haven't we passed this infrastructure bill? It passed the U.S. Senate with 69 votes 2 months ago. I have been very straight on television. We're tired of the chitty chat up in Washington. Get in a room and get this figured out.
And then a few weeks later, still over a week before Election Day, ABC News pundits tell you who to blame.
And McAuliffe wins by 2.9 points, let's say.
Even if Terry McAuliffe wins by a little,
this will still be seen as a rebuke of the progressives who have not figured out that they do not speak for the vast majority of Americans. And in fact, most Americans, when they hear them speak, think, oh my, that's not even the language that I'm talking about. You know, David Shore.
That was ABC News contributor Sarah Isker.
This becomes the truth. The universal truth, right?
In D.C.
In D.C.
Which is the only place that matters.
The only place that matters. This is where the truth is created.
And then once it is universal truth, the conventional wisdom in D.C., it's totally okay for CNN journalists to just open up interviews with progressives asking how much blame they're going to take.
Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who chairs the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Congresswoman Jayapal, you saw what happened last night. Do you take any blame in this?
A week later, Greg Kosar launches this campaign. City council member who a lot of people knew, and a lot of people knew because he was at the front lines of trying to do something brand new, of trying to actually address the public safety conversation in a very deep and meaningful way, and actually was one of the creators of this policy in Austin that actually managed to restructure the local police budget in a pretty significant way and reallocate resources into community programs.
Yes, right after the peak of the George Floyd uprisings in August 2020,
Austin City Council voted unanimously to slash the police department's budget by $150 million. That is about a third of its total operating budget. So
Councilman Kosar was a big part of that effort, reallocating a third of Austin's police budget to non-police alternatives.
It's going to be reallocated into areas like violence prevention, food access, and abortion access programs. Then over the
This wasn't an easy win, obviously. It faced voter backlash. I don't think it's permanent. But yeah, Greg has not stepped back from that.
And now he wins. And he doesn't just win, right? He wins big while staying course on what he believes in, standing his ground despite the fact that his opponent, a quote-unquote pragmatic progressive, whatever that means, throws all of the possible bad faith conservative talking points, the nastiest mailers, the nastiest ad, right? All of that, and Greg Kosar still manages to win.
Yes, I got lots of votes on this ballot, but actually $15 an hour won tonight. Yeah. Medicare for All won tonight. Yeah. The PRO Act won tonight. Yeah. Reproductive rights won tonight. Immigrant rights won tonight. The movement for Black Lives won tonight. LGBTQIA rights won tonight.
I feel like this is so significant because there's this boogeyman in DC politics and Dem politics, right? Of all of the things that people are like too afraid to address. And here's somebody who has a voting record, has proposals, has all of these things that heavily lean into the movement. And he wins handedly. We should talk about that. We should talk about that a lot.
Alex, you got to go down to Texas 35 in the lead up to the election. Were there any signs of this dunk from the Greg Kosar for Congress campaign coming?
I think from the moment that I walked into the office, there were two things that I noticed, which was one, Greg is one of the hardest working candidates I've ever seen. He was in the middle of launching canvas kickoffs. He had a phone bank kickoff with Ayanna Pressley going in the background. The second thing I noticed was that the team of people, from the volunteers that made up the campaign to the head campaign manager to all of the political and field staff, have all been with Greg and following him since kind of the beginning, seeing him as a young organizer to getting on the city council and winning real progressive fights at the local level. So definitely didn't want to take anything for granted, but once getting on the ground and seeing how hard everybody worked, including Greg himself, setting the tone, they earned that victory.
Yeah, my reaction to the race is, it's interesting to me that people like Greg Kosar, people like Ayanna Pressley, people like Alex Morse, these local politicians who want to take their experience on municipal politics to the federal level. They have to go to organizations like Justice Democrats and Working Families Party and the Sunrise Movement to build an infrastructure to get to Congress. Often the Democratic Party infrastructure is either neutral or actively opposing these progressive municipal officials from going to federal office. In a normal society, normal political system, like someone like Ayanna Pressley or Alex Morse or Greg Kassar, you know, they would maybe get some lifting up and backing from like the official Democratic Party apparatus and infrastructure because they're promising young elected officials on the municipal level who should be lifted up. But no one is going to create that support and infrastructure except for progressive movement. And so that's what's cool to me is that in the past, you might have had these municipal figures like not fully commit themselves to the progressive movement because there was no real progressive movement to speak of electorally on the level of getting to federal office, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
One last question on Greg Kassar. Texas's 35th district is solidly blue, and if Greg wants to stay in Congress for a while, I would assume that won't be too hard in this kind of seat. And so when we caught up with him at the AOC rally in Laredo, on the off chance that he really might win, we asked him what it means to be a Justice Democrat and how he would take that approach into Congress. Here's what he had to say.
To me, being a Justice Democrat is about being accountable to our people. And it's also about not just being one vote over there in Congress. It's about being able to actually carry and hold the responsibility of organizing an entire community. I think that going to be in Congress, you might be one of 435 people, but you can actually play a role of being able to help, you know, build a coalition and be 10 members of Congress, be 20 members of Congress worth of work and commitment. I've seen Justice Democrats go and sleep on the steps of the Capitol and actually extend eviction moratoriums, keeping thousands of people in their homes. They didn't have to go and wait for decades to move up in seniority and rank.
I mean, one other thing about Greg Kassar that a lot of people don't know is he was, I believe, the chair of this little known but important organization called Local Progress, which is the national network of progressive municipal officials. And their job is to like talk to city council member in Boston, talk to city council member in Minneapolis, talks to DA in San Francisco to try to come up with progressive policies on the municipal level. You know, I believe Chuy Garcia was a part of that. Ayanna Pressley was a part of that. Larry Krasner, like tons of progressive national figures that come from this organization. And so I'm really excited for Greg because I think he'll bring that experience to the Progressive Caucus, to the squad, and make it into an even stronger organizing vehicle.
Yeah, I think some of the things that are some of the hardest things that legislators have to do, and I'm certainly Greg has gone through this a number of times, and so do all of the Justice Democrats that are in the House right now, is like a willingness to lean in to difficult conversations, whether it's about policy or these questions around organizing. It's not just win-lose binary, but it's about having a much longer term view of a sustained organized community that can build power in different seats over time, cycle after election cycle, whether it's building a bench of talent to power campaigns or to ascend office themselves, or, you know, on election night, all the people, there's probably at least over 100 people, if not way more than that, that were shouting, that were crying, that were hugging each other. And it's because they have now been a part of these fights. I think that it's massive, I think, having someone that's coming in with this organizing lens and being able to actually lean into the debate.
I feel like we've not been very subtle about what we want to accomplish. I mean, this podcast is called Block Party. So, I mean, it's right there in the name. We want to make sure that we don't just elect progressive people on policy merits, but we really elect folks who are ready to do the hard work of organizing their colleagues and working together as a collective in Congress. Congress in general, as we've talked about in so many episodes, it's a really tough place. It's a really tough place, and good intentions and a good heart are just not enough to make it and to get the policies passed that we want to pass. And so we need folks who know and understand that they need to organize with others and really, really commit to collective power and collective action.
It's a season 2 motto. Good intentions are not enough.
They're not enough, y'all.
zooming out away from just Greg and Texas 35, you could say progressives and the left start out the 2022 Democratic primary season 1-0 with Cisneros versus Cuellar going to extra time. Is that a result that you think is deserving of celebration, or are you level-headed, maybe even a little disappointed you couldn't knock out Cuellar in the first round?
I'm going to tell y'all the truth. These people never celebrate nothing, okay? They were already on to the plotting and the planning and the working for the runoff. Waleed was asked, how'd you feel election night? And he just gave you the whole spiel as to how
I was like, who do you mean down. These people? Do you mean pundits or do you mean Waleed and Alex?
I'm talking like, people at Justice Democrat. No, because the work never stops. Like sharks, you just got to keep on. You're just always focused in on the kill. No.
The nonviolent kill. Nonviolent kill.
And this time around, Henry got just 767 more votes than Jessica. Another excruciatingly close contest. Waleed, you mentioned the third candidate, Tania Benavides, got 2,289 votes, almost 5% of the total vote. For us, do we deserve to feel good about it?
Yes, because Jessica was unable to take Cuellar to a runoff last cycle, and she was this time. That's an improvement based on last cycle. And I think people sometimes forget, partly due to the success of the progressive movement and JD, like how difficult it is to unseat an incumbent. 97% of incumbents are reelected. And even if there's an FBI investigation and like liberals and progressives are like, wow, this is damning and like an indictment on him, and he's of course going to lose. Like on the ground, there's a lot of fear of Cuellar and the machine and fear of retribution. He, like, his brother is the sheriff. His sister is also an elected official. There's an elementary school named after him. And a lot of what you hear is like, he might be shady, but he's our guy. And if he knows that we went against him, we might get fucked. And so I think that is a major factor in this primary. There's a lot of, you know, Laredo is not a large place. Everyone knows each other. Everyone knows each other's family. And I just named three Cuellars who run the Democratic Party in Laredo, and they definitely, you know, call in their favors and strike fear into the hearts of voters. And so I think Jess is well set up for the runoff. It'll be a low turnout race, which means it'll be less expensive to contact voters. And I think with the third candidate out, you can consolidate the progressive plus anti-Cuellar coalition and send Jessica to Congress.
I think that we should be incredibly excited about the results because everything that we did mattered to be able to get to this point where, like Waleed said, we were in a runoff position where we weren't last cycle. We had the element of surprise last time. We had a presidential year turnout. This time, we didn't have that. Cuellar is running a much more sophisticated operation this time, started this campaign with a lot more name ID, but we also are still the underdogs. Like, we have to fight for every volunteer, every piece of media coverage. It's always a grind. And Jessica does not have a super wealthy network of corporate donors that she can just call in, or the entire infrastructure of the Democratic Party establishment. So it took everything from everyone to be able to get to where we are. And so it all matters. And now we have to do that again. And so I think being incredibly proud of how far we've come and how far we still have to go is a sobering thought. So I'm really proud. But everything also that didn't get done really matters too.
I just have to also just talk about the media framing of this race, which is that basically has been, if Jessica wins, it will be because she did not campaign as a progressive. And if she loses, it's because she will have campaigned as a progressive. So
that's right.
That's
called professional political analysis.
That's the Washington spin of the Cisneros race, is that regardless of what happens, it will not be because of the progressive movement doing something helpful.
Just like Democrats' midterms in 2022. We actually know in advance.
Just like the Terry McAuliffe race, who was a moderate.
A moderate who had the job, who was governor previously, yes.
Anyway, we talk about Virginia too much, but let's get back to Texas. For those who may not know, the New York Times did a long profile of this race. Jonathan Weissman, who is a long friend of Justice Democrats and myself, wrote the profile, and he describes the campaign as the following. She still favors Medicare for all, a $15 minimum wage, more liberal immigration policies, and abortion rights, but those have not been her focus. Instead, she has played up her biography and hit Mr. Cuellar hard on rising prices. She has portrayed him as a Washington insider, greasing his pockets with money from big corporations, and presented herself as embodying the struggling community he left behind. The very next paragraph, after the New York Times establishes that Cisneros is running a negative attack campaign on Cuellar, quotes Jessica's first campaign ad. It says, "My medicines cost more. Insurance costs more. Now it's food and gas, but we don't make more. If you ask me, Henry Cuellar has been in Washington too long." This is an ad about Medicare for all. His argument just falls apart within the same three paragraphs that he's written. Cisneros isn't running an issues-focused campaign. Here's an ad about healthcare costs.
Yeah.
And this isn't just the New York Times. Now here, I'm going to read the Politico article, which is, the title of the Politico article is, "The Left's South Texas Star Isn't the Progressive They Warned You About." Who warned who?
Well, you know what? It is backwards designed from right-wing messaging, because they're like, the right wing tells you these scare tactics, and that is what the left is. And Cisneros is not like the scary thing, which means
Cisneros
she's not.
Cisneros is a human being. Okay, here's the paragraph from Politico. "The national progressive movement will eagerly embrace Cisneros if she can defeat Cuellar next week. And many liberals would greet a primary win as a new path to taking down more centrist incumbents. Still, her campaign is much more focused on kitchen table issues like jobs and healthcare costs than on the ambitious vision that high-profile progressives are pushing on Capitol Hill." Which I'm like, the two big issues that progressives on Capitol Hill are known for is the Green New Deal jobs program and Medicare for all. Second, this is the complete opposite take that the New York Times gave in the same week, which was that she's not talking about issues at all. So, you know, who is the real Jessica Cisneros? Well, I guess we'll find out. But anyway, Wow. That is...
I'm so happy we could have this communications catharsis, comms catharsis with Waleed.
This
G.
really irked his nerve. He really got that out. Like, he was animated.
Okay, Waleed got to let it out. Rojas, I'm going to give you the last word.
It's now Justice Democrats' third cycle. And with each win, there is always a spin on why progressives are not winning, or that this was a fluke, or that this is a one in a million candidate, or this district is like so unique, or these seats are too easy. And I still get fired up hearing Waleed read the quotes from these journalists that know what they are doing. But the reality is that we are growing each and every cycle. Incumbents that have been in office for decades, losing power, and I feel like the media misses that point. That's why it matters that, like, our candidate, you know, AOC started off with a 60,000 fundraising quarter, and now we're seeing six figures, like, across the board for, like, every Justice Democrat that has very small networks of teachers, union organizers, local activists, just people that can only give 10 that are going up against people that can call for max out. So I just think that this is something that we should expect. We're going to expect it in May. We're going to expect it in June. We're going to expect it every time. And it's part of what makes the work that we do so exciting. And we are proving them wrong every single time.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel more inspired to go back to work.
Badass. I was like, yeah.
I like that take. Every time you say it's a fluke, 2018, you said that. And yet I'm still, I'm still here.
It's just such a lazy view.
Y'all still mad about Joe Crowley. That's what it is. Alex, Amira, Waleed, thanks for joining us on Block Party.
Shout out to the Hot Cheeto Sushi in Laredo.
All right, that's the show. Our mix engineer is Rocky Russo. Our producer for this episode, Becca Rose and Emma DeSau. Special thanks, as always, to Amy Westervelt and Critical Frequency. The excellent interlude music for this episode was written by Koji Kondo, arranged and performed by Skatoon Network. See you on the block.
Bye. Thanks so much for having me.
The boss was on the pod, so I was on my best behavior. Thank you. Bye.